to Money Talks. My name is Mike Campbell. I'm glad you're with us. You know, I've got Ryan Irvine's going to join us. Talk about a business where what have you done for me lately? Well, Ryan and his team at Keystone Financial has a wonderful track record, including coming on this show October 2022 and recommending Hammond Power. Now, it wasn't the first time. He'd been recommending it on this show for years. It's been the best performing stock period over the, you know, you name it, 5 years, 10 years, that kind of stuff. But since that October 22nd, it's up 625%. Obviously, I'm going to ask him about that. But as I said, it's a what have you done for me lately business. I'll be asking exactly what has he got for us now. I'm also going to have a good news story. Rarely have these on this show. But, you know, some people just step up. They do it for the community. And Thea and Troy Siebert do exactly that with Bluegrass Farms, helping out Special Olympics. But here's the twist. I want to know why a small business in Armstrong, BC, it's a great bed and breakfast plus other things, why do they step up? What do they get out of it? And I think you're going to love hearing this story with Troy, and we'll do that. Of course, I've got a goofy award. I got a shocking stat. I got Rob Levy coming on. You know, we got the StatsCan report this week about inflation. Not so fast. If you start looking into what it costs to own a home and to buy a home, several times more than the rate of inflation. Of course, I've got Victor and I've got Ozzy, all of that coming your way. So, as I say, great show planned for you. But first, former Green Party leader Elizabeth May stated that the climate debate in the House of Commons is unserious and profoundly unfunny. Well, I agree with that. I mean, it's on the short list for most talked about topics in Canada, but it's always done without context. I mean, for example, Canada emits 1.5% of global emissions. By BC's 13/100 of a percent of global emissions. Alberta, about 0.5% of global emissions. You know, as Prime Minister Trudeau put it in an October 20th, 2018 interview in the popular Quebec program, Tout le monde en parle, he states in quotes, even if Canada stopped everything tomorrow and the other countries didn't have any solutions, it wouldn't make a big difference. Prime Minister or Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland stated February 5th, 2020, interview with the Financial Times, even if all Canadians ceased emitting carbon, we wouldn't move the dial. So let me be blunt. The level of focus on climate issues by some in the public and the media, when Canada can't do much about it, in quotes, can't move the dial, I mean, it's a bit much. We've got so many other issues facing this country. I mean, you know them. Affordable housing and rents, lack of family doctors, you know, the cost of living. I mean, my goodness, causing huge financial stress or worse for about half of Canadians. We got the Chinese infiltration. We got GDP per capita forecast to be the worst in the OECD. And we're talking about something that the Prime Minister himself says won't make a difference. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't take action. Yeah, I'm saying we take action, but, and it's a big but, we shouldn't adopt any policy that's not had a cost-benefit analysis, and that includes the carbon tax. For the record, you know, before this became a political football in 2018 at the federal level, I was in favor of BC's carbon tax 10 years earlier. But I had one condition. All revenue, every cent collected, must be returned to individuals and business. That was the key component that made it acceptable to both economists, business, and individuals. I mean, every tax is negative for economic growth, but by returning all the revenue back to individuals and business, well, you mitigate the impact. I think that's at the core why the UN, UN Environmental Program, other international bodies recommended the BC model. And given the Prime Minister and Finance Minister's own word says we can't move the dial, a higher cost isn't justified. The point is, the original carbon tax was designed to encourage emissions reductions, not raise money for government. But you know what? The revenue proved too tempting for government. First in BC, BC Liberal government started to include existing tax breaks in their formula for revenue neutrality. NDP takes office 2017. They actually gut the revenue neutral provisions altogether and keep the majority of the revenue. Now the NDP includes expenditures on green projects in its calculation of revenue neutrality. Come on, that's a farce. You know, individuals earning over $61,000, by the way, receive nothing. Only those earning $39,000 or lower get the full rebate, and that's maxed out at $504. But federally also, Parliamentary Budget Office found that individuals have received only a small portion of the promised rebates. and small business has received virtually nothing of what was promised. Now, federal government says it's going to keep $500 million in carbon tax revenues from business, and they're going to put it elsewhere. Well, that's clearly a promise broken at a time when, you know, businesses are trying to recover from the pandemic restrictions. They've got increased costs, including taxation. And now the rebate promise is reneged on? You know what? Rarely mentioned, though, this is important in all the talk about rebates or no rebates, is the GST is charged on the carbon tax. There's 22 fuels getting it, by the way. This year, the Parliamentary Budget Office estimates that Canadians will pay $486 million in GST on the carbon tax. There's no refund for that. And finally, again, what do we get in return? Well, not much, according to Liberals' hand-picked Environment Commissioner. Jerry DeMarco found that there's been zero emission reductions in Canada. Worst performer than G7 under both the Harper Conservatives and now the Trudeau Liberals. But somehow people are surprised that there's opposition, especially facing a 23% increase in the carbon tax. Hey, I'm glad you're with us. I still want to remind you, though, go to Money Talks Tweets, mikesmoneytalks.ca, and you can sign up for 5 minutes with Mike's there and go to Michael Campbell's Money Talks on Facebook. Stay with us. Got a couple of great stories for you. Ryan Irvine on deck. I always enjoy getting a chance to talk with Ryan Irvine of Keystone Financial, keystocks.com, Keystone Financial. And Ryan, first of all, I'm glad you're with us because I'm going to start with one of the best questions you've ever heard. That is, you recommended Hammond Power Systems to our audience, I think, 5 years ago. And you then reiterated at the World Outlook Conference. You did it again. You know what? That's the best performing stock in that time frame. I mean, was it $3 or something when you started? Because it's now over 120.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back. For us, it's a overnight success story. And thanks for having me on again, by the way. Thank you very much. But it's an overnight success story about 2 decades in the making. It goes back to 2000. The stock was at 60 cents then. It closed today around 120, but we recommended it on your show way back at $1.15, and then at your conference 5 years ago in the $6-$7 range, and just on your show in the fall of 2022 when it was $16, and it has just hit that inflection point where it went from a boring business that made transformers. I always say not Autobots and Decepticons. They make transformers that step up and step down power. And they've done it for years. They used to trade at 6-7 times earnings and grow at a reasonable clip. You've seen the infrastructure grid in the U.S. Deteriorate, and Hammond Power has become sexy. They power every Tesla charging station. You'll find a Hammond Power transformer at those in Canada. And, growth rates went up significantly during the pandemic, 50% from where you were looking at 10 to 15%. So the stock was so undervalued that even though it's gone from $1 to 120, it doesn't trade at the sky high valuations we sometimes see when you see a company do that type of gain. It's about 25 times earnings versus companies that, you know, have 25 times sales when they make a gain like that. Now, we have taken half of our position off the table because it's responsible to take some profit. It is literally up 20,000%. So we're taking some off based on the fundamentals. It grows about 10 to 12% organically annually. So we would more like to see it in the range of maybe 15 to 20 times. At 25 times, it is above our fair value in the near term. Having said that, we are still holding a very significant position because we think Hammond Power is going to go from the $600 million range right now in terms of revenues by the end of this decade to about $1 billion. So we want to be participated in that sector. We see tailwinds. It's not going to be like this, though. It's going like I'm doing a straight linear line going up. It's going to be a jagged line going up, but we still see upside over the long term in this business. It increases its dividend every year. So it's a well-run company. Again, 20 years in the making, the success story, but the market is now starting to pay attention to Hammond Power. We like to get in early when there's good cash flow, when people aren't paying attention.
But actually, that's your formula on Keystone yep. Financial. Since the very outset, when I met you as a young cub, I didn't even have gray hair then. That's been the formula. Find undiscovered
companies.
I didn't
have children then.
There you go. And that will give you gray hair, by the way. But I love the success story, of course. It's congratulations.
It's common, I know.
Congratulations to you and the team. But come on, I'll just go short term. October 2022. We're not 2 years away from that. It's up 600%+ since then. So, by the way, I'm giving that a big check mark. That's how I do that. You know, I understand the markets. That's a big, good thing. So, anyways, congratulations.
We found it. That's often good for our clients. Yes, yeah. We found that.
Let me skip on, though, again. So from here on in, though, let's assume people got in, say, that October time and, you know, lots of money on the table. You took half, as you said. Do you still piece out or do you get prepared to buy on any, you know, significant pullback? You know, I am talking 15% pullback or something.
Yeah, we'd have to see about a 25% pullback for us to get very interested again. In the near term, we're going to take our half position off the table. I mean, we have client, often we'll have a stock. I mean, we would like it to happen all the time, but if a stock doubles, we might take half our position. You've taken all your initial capital off the table. In this case, many clients could have taken 10% off and they took their initial position off the table. But one of our philosophies is to let winners ride. And a lot of investment advisors don't do this. They're always paring back a position to keep it in the range of like 3% in a portfolio. Well, we use Warren Buffett's teachings on this. And he gave a little speech he always does at their Berkshire annual meeting last year. And he talked about saying that investing in his entire lifetime in the market, 60 years, it was just 12 stocks that have really driven his portfolio. And he likes to buy and hold those. Now, you take some position out, but if you've taken all your risk out of that position, we like to let our winners run if you want to beat the market. And I'm always talking to people who want to beat the market. If you want to get a market average return, just buy three ETFs and get the lowest cost on those. And like I give you that advice for free, just do that. But if you're trying to beat the market, you need to have those winners in your portfolio because you're going to make mistakes. And a winner like Hammond Power can allow you to make mistakes. But if you always keep trimming its position in your portfolio and keeping it at a very low percentage of your portfolio, you're going to miss out on those gains. Certainly be prudent. Take your initial position off the table, but let a great company grow over time. And that's how you make wealth in the markets. We've seen that with Boyd. Boyd is a company we've never taken a penny out of the company because it continues to trade at reasonable valuation. So if we can find a winner and ride it out long term, that's what we're trying to do. It's the best case scenario. Let's hold on to those great businesses.
Let me come to the broader application there. We've seen a sharp rise in the stock markets, you know, all-time highs, flirting right there. Does it change, I don't know, your approach or how do you look at your portfolio, that kind of stuff? Has it changed the game for growth-oriented, you know, smaller companies?
Yeah, and that's a really good point. One of the things that for us has changed the game, and this is a bit of inside baseball. I'll give you a couple companies that we looked at, the way we look at small caps and investing in companies. But you see, and I hammer this point home all the time. We talk about looking at great balance sheets, good cash flow. It becomes part of the noise sometimes. But the crux of the argument, it's really hit home as you've seen interest rates rise over the past 2 to 3 years. So a good cash producing growth stock could fund debt or get debt at, you know, 2.5 to even 5%, sometimes lower over the 2 years ago. Now, today they are paying 8.5 to 12.5 plus. In some cases, their cost of growth capital is up 3 to 4 times. Mm-hmm. We just did a report where we looked through about 3,000 companies in Canada. It's called our Canadian Small Cap Cash Rich Stock Report. Try saying that 3 times fast. We got to work on those names, but it really rolls off the tongue. But we look at 3,000 stocks. It takes us 2 to 3 months. We end up with about 75 stocks that loosely meet this criteria, cash rich and are profitable. There's some more that goes into it, but that's the basic. We interview management teams and really looking for good businesses. And we added 3 stocks. The common thing was they were all net cash, which means more cash in the bank than debt. One of the biggest items we noted, there's the fundamental change that has happened to some of these businesses with the rate increase. I'm going to give you an example of two companies. I love to give examples that make it simple. And we sat down with both these teams. One of them we've been sitting down with for four years looking for an entry point, and we finally found it in September. But the other one is a good juxtaposition. They're both specialty pharma companies in Canada, so they sell drugs into the Canadian market. One had $50 million in net cash, so $50 million in cash. The other one had $50 million in net debt. So when debt costed 3%, we still preferred the net cash company, but with the net debt company, that interest payment was about $1.5 million in a year. So it's not great, but it's not affecting cash flow tremendously. With debt costing them 10%, that's $5 million now in interest that's going out the door, and that eats into cash flow. The juxtaposition is the $50 million net cash position company used to get nothing on that cash. Now they get 5% on the cash. So they're getting $2.5 million a year for it just sitting there. So it's a $7.5 million difference in cash flow in these businesses. And that makes a big difference. So paying attention to the balance sheet has been huge, particularly in this environment where for smaller companies, it's actually been harder to raise money and debt is more expensive. So yes, you have that cash flow difference too, but the main thing is they can't execute on their growth by acquisition strategy, whereas the company with cash can do it. There's so many things they can do with that cash to allocate. They can buy back shares, they can pay dividends, invest in their business, buy other businesses to grow. Now, again, all that sounds good in theory, I hope, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Straightforward.
So does it matter in terms of the share prices is what really you probably want to ask, right? Well, those two companies, the specialty pharma business that we recommended in September, and we like the company, it's called Cipher Pharmaceutical, CPH on the TSX. They sell the number one doctor prescribed acne treatment drug in Canada. That's their core business. Profitable, $50 million in net cash. So it was $3.24 in September. The other company is Medexus, profitable, but trading at $3 in September, but net $50 million in net debt. So since that time, Cipher bought back $6 million in their shares, spent $6 million to buy back, substantial course issuer bid, had a good quarter, added to cash. The stock is $9.03 today. So it's up 178%. Medexus is the debt-heavy company of those two. It's profitable, but the interest they're paying, the cost of capital going forward for them is higher. Well, the stock, it's harder to grow in that environment, in this environment. Now they're down to $1.57, so down 47%. Between those companies, a massive swing in 6 months. And this is very long-winded, but I'll say this is where Buffett's quote on a rising tide floats all boats. When the tide goes out, you discover who's been swimming naked. And we've really seen that over the past year in the small cap arena. Growth stocks that have been disciplined, have great cash positions, really have a chance to allocate capital for shareholder benefit now. And you're the ones that are doing it, and they're well positioned right now. I think it's an inflection point and can continue going forward. But the ones in our portfolio that have this cash and good profitable businesses, they're well positioned right now. The flip side, the other companies are not.
Just I'm digressing just a little bit, but we talked to a lot of people. We're going to talk to Mark Brown in a minute about the small caps in the resource sector, and specifically silver in that case. But across the board, talking to people in the gold sector, and they say they can't believe with a record price of gold, their stocks aren't performing across the board. It isn't just an individual stock. Have you guys looked at that sector? And would you advise, if I was going to look at it, what you've just alluded to is sort of the key component is to look at what their net cash flow is or their net cash position.
Yeah, it's so key. If we ever do look at a resource company, you got to look at cash flow, but the balance sheet is so key in that segment. And companies with net cash, because you're beholden to an underlying commodity, if silver goes up, if gold goes up, your margins improve. If you're a producer, the opposite happens. So, you need that. You need the ability to survive in a down environment. Plus, then they can go out and buy other businesses in that environment, which is what we love to see. So the minimum criteria in that sector you're talking about is a great balance sheet. And I'll talk about a company and recommend it today to your viewers, listeners, that is in the gold sector that has performed well over this period, but it has that buffer of cash. You need that, and it's so important for investors to look at that segment.
Let's not wait any longer. Let's start with that one.
Okay, let's get into it. And we've talked about this company a number of times on the show, but it's Dynacor. They are in the gold sector. They have performed well over the past year. $4, $3, or 3.45% dividend, $146 million market cap. It's a very simple business model. They purchase ore from small scale or artisanal miners in various regions of Peru, process it at their mill in Peru, and sell the extracted gold and silver internationally at market prices. As a result, profitability for the company, it depends on two things: a margin between the price of ore and the market price of gold. The higher the margin, the better. And throughput, the amount of ore being put through the mill, the more efficient, the more money they make. There's another third thing that's really important too that I sometimes fail to mention. A higher gold pricing environment incentivizes more smaller scale miners to bring ore to their mill. Gold is at record highs. There's more and more bringing artisanal miners bringing it to their mill, and the company's more profitable, which is what we look at and what we like. I'll just look at the financials in the last quarter: 38% growth in revenues to $63 million, EBITDA 51%, EPS or earnings per share, what we literally look at, 250% increase. The growth trends trajectory of this company is what we're looking at going forward. We invested in them 5 years ago in the $1.50, $1.75 range. They didn't have a dividend. They implemented a dividend. Every year they've increased it. But the plan then was we said, you know what, $4, that's going to be a great return for us over that period. They had one mill, but now they've built up so much cash in the bank. They have, 30 plus million in cash, no debt. They are looking to go to other markets and employ the same strategy. So put mills, another one in Peru, one somewhere in West Africa, and another Latin American country. So 3 to 5 years from now, we would expect this company to not just have one mill like they do today, four plants. So you have the potential for 3 to 4 times the business over the next 3 to 5 years. And that's why we continue to own them today. You're talking about, when we saw Hammond Power, the rise in that business. Now reevaluate the business when it's gone up. Do you still want to own it? Well, now that they could potentially replicate that successful model in other markets, it makes sense to continue to own it and get paid a 3.5% dividend and watch the company grow. So that's what we expect. We'll buy it today. It trades at about 6 times earnings cash out. The market trades at 20 times. I love to buy things that trade below the market and grow at above the market rate. That's what Dynacor is doing, so we'll continue to own it and buy more today.
And I don't want to preempt, because you're doing it, I'll let people know that you guys are doing a live webinar. It's called, yes, Simplify Your Stock Portfolio in 224, and you're going to talk about specific stocks they could buy today. So I don't, yes, want to preempt too much, but I'll ask you for one more in a second. I'll just remind people that's April 2nd at 7 p.m. Pacific, April 11th at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can just get more information at mikesmoneytalks.ca or go to keystocks.com, keystocks.com, to get more information. So as I say, I don't want to preempt that. It's kind of unfair. You do all the work and I say, hey, give me the extra, but give me just one more, okay? Just one more example.
For sure.
That you're looking at.
For sure. A really simple digital Canadian bank success story. It's VersaBank, VBNK on the TSX. They trade around 1450, 1440, pay a small yield, about 0.67%, but we're looking for capital appreciation from this company. They're a leader in business-to-business digital banking, as well as technology solutions for cybersecurity. Again, we like the numbers. There's a great leverage to earnings on this business, low operating cost, just 11% growth in revenue in the last quarter, but 41% growth in EPS, up to 48 cents per share, 2% sequentially. Our estimate on this company is about $2 per share in earnings this year, just a 10 times multiple. So we're not pricing it heavily. We'll get you to $20. That's a significant lift from the $14.50 that it's trading at today. They have a successful program that they operate, business model in Canada. They've bought a bank in the U.S. so they can move that model to the U.S. We'd expect an inflection point as they announce entering the U.S. market over the next year. They can replicate, again, we love companies that do something successful in one market, able to replicate it in another market. I think VersaBank can do that over the course of this year. It's done well over the past year. We expect it to continue well into 2024 and 2025.
And let me just remind people, you know, you get these, you know, I subscribe to KeyStocks or Keystone Financial, and you can find them at keystocks.com, but I subscribe to them. But then you go and you look at your own portfolio to determine what's appropriate. They talk a lot about risk. Aaron Dunn and Ryan Irvine talk a lot about risk management. If you've got a yes. professional, you sort of run it by them. You say, where does this fit in my portfolio, et cetera. But you also do that in your portfolio webinars. You explain to people how to build a portfolio, how to not get overexposed, as you just mentioned with Hammond Power. You sold half of it. You got all your risk out of it. But yes. I just want to point that out. You confer with your professional with this kind of information. And I would really encourage people to take advantage of these webinars. I mean, that's where you grow your sophistication, your level of sophistication. And as I just mentioned, you know, Ryan's got one coming up April 2nd, 7 p.m. Pacific. I'll give the details, MikesMoneyTalks.ca. We'll put them on KeyStocks.com. April 11th, following week, 7 p.m. Eastern time. There is a early bird price, by the way, is $29.95, which is awfully inexpensive. But they'll also have 7 stocks that you can buy today. But you put them within that context. What's appropriate for me? What's my, what's my risk tolerance, et cetera, et cetera? What else do I own? All of that stuff. And they deal with that in their webinars. And Ryan, I look forward to it. And I appreciate you sharing some preempting stuff there, putting you on the spot and saying, give me a couple of examples. But always such a pleasure to talk with you. Fine work on your part. Congratulations.
We always quote you at those webinars. You said years ago, an educated investor is a better investor. And we say, quoting Michael Campbell here. And we so believe in that. And we sit down for 3 hours and yep. You'll just get that simple 15 to 25 stock portfolio. We encourage anybody who's listening, come there. We'll give you 6 to 8 stocks you can buy today. And we'd love to see you at those seminars.
Great stuff, Ryan. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me on.
Of course, we got our inflation numbers this past week. Sort of the U.S. got Jerome Powell talking about, but in Canada, February was 2.8%, down from 2.9% in January. But there's a bigger story behind that, and I'm going to bring Rob Levy in to chat with us about it. You know, Rob, one of my themes is that we screwed up the housing market so badly. And this is the, food and housing are the two ways you can't do that. If you want to have social unrest, make it a problem for people to eat or a place to live. And man, I looked at those inflation numbers and I know you did some work digging a little deeper. Man, it's no 2.8%, whether you're renting or owning.
No, absolutely right, Mike. And maybe we just go back to the old way of looking at it, excluding things like food and housing, but that doesn't really tell, as you say, the full story, because those are sort of the major components of CPI, which impact the average individual on a monthly basis. You talk about food component, it's upwards, I think, 17% of the index, where housing's around 28% of the index. So it's just the unescapable parts of inflation that hit the consumer on a monthly basis. And even, a few months past these higher interest rates, but it's still being felt with the increase in mortgage interest costs, because even something like that, still up 26% on a year-over-year basis.
Yeah, I mean, I know what they're doing, like as economists doing that kind of stuff, but none of us can skip. We're only interested in the cost of living. You know, and inflation is the measure of the growth in the cost of living. So yeah, it's 2.8% tacked on, but hey, none of us can avoid the food thing. None of us can avoid the shelter thing. And as I said, when you dig inside the shelter, and it's beyond just mortgage rates, which of course are very important, but it's beyond mortgage rates.
Exactly right. And that's almost the point. I mean, there is the fact that the Bank of Canada has contributed to the increase in housing inflation in that specific segment of the consumer price index. The fact that they've increased policy interest rates, and there's a direct correlation with mortgage rates. And, you know, hence we see it was as high as the low 30% year over year increase in mortgage interest costs and, you know, receding slightly as the month goes on. So down at 26.6%. Year-over-year spike, but other areas still within shelter that are seeing some of that shelter inflation that you see in the monthly numbers. Electricity almost up 11%, rent over 8%, insurance, and I know insurance is one that affects many households because people sort of talk about it, chatter about it. Did you see how much my home insurance went up this year? And their number was 7%, but you talk to some of the brokers, and these are, you know, anecdotal on the ground stories, but people seeing premium increases, you know, as much as 20%. So it definitely that shelter component of inflation is one that hits hard, and it's not just as it relates to mortgage interest costs.
And the other one, and again, this is a very average number, but we see many jurisdictions with really strong, many times over the rate of inflation for property taxes. And I'm sorry, Rob, because one of my bugaboos is, you know, I must admit, I really get tired of politicians pretending I'm an idiot. And, you know, other people can decide and say, bring it. I am an idiot, so I'm happy with that. I'm not. I think it's disrespectful to the public, disrespectful to me. And when they say, I care about affordable housing, and oh, yeah, I'm going to raise property taxes twice the rate of inflation on average. And in some jurisdictions, as I say, Rob, many more times than that.
Yeah, and it's the fact that it comes year after year. So, you know, similar to these inflation numbers, and I think food is the easy example. Well, you know, food inflation in February was only a couple percent. Yeah, but it follows the fact that it was 10% last year. So at the grocery store, you know, we're still used to paying significantly more money. And as you said, as it relates to property taxes, it's not just that, you know, property taxes are more than the rate of inflation in the last year. I mean, this goes back three, four, you know, as long as you think to want to go back and maybe make yourself sick about it. But it is these significant increases on an annual basis. So taxes as that component of shelter inflation in February, up 4.9%.
Yeah, and I just reiterate that, again, I think the media sometimes gets a little confused and inflation is the deal. No, it's the cost of living that's the deal. So if we had this huge rise in prices and then zero inflation, I'm still paying that huge rise in prices. And food's a great example. You're right, we were much higher rate of inflation last year, but we're up 21% in 3 years. You know, I mean, who doesn't notice that when they're shopping? And the property tax, as you say, it's a really good point you're making. It's compounding. It's on top of last year's increases and the year before's increases. And that's a point. I always come back to this is becoming unaffordable for over half of Canadians. And rents are part of that. You know, you heard Rob talk about insurance, et cetera, property tax. That's going to be reflected in your rent, too. You don't get to say, well, I'm not a homeowner, so it's not impacting me. Yes, it is.
Yeah, exactly right, Mike. You know, it sort of comes at it every which way and, you know, continues to be felt. And, you know, to the point of where we started off, too, and the fact that inflation is starting to moderate maybe a little bit, especially when you look at these areas where there's actual, you know, year over year declines in price levels in some categories. This is where the weight on the consumer is really, you know, starting to be felt and hopefully, you know, soon to be noticed by the Bank of Canada because the changes are coming. They say June, but perhaps this is the surprise might be a little sooner than expected, given what you're seeing elsewhere in the economy.
Rob, forgive me. I'm going to change gears just for a second here because you're the head of Border Gold. So I want to talk gold just for a second here. We've seen these all-time highs. But what I like is you're on the ground. You're talking to people. They come into Border Gold, or of course they can do it online too at bordergold.com. But so you're seeing sort of the action. I just wanted to get what's been the reaction to these all-time highs?
The majority of it has been customers liquidating, selling, and you know, I think part of it is, you know, the customer, we have a relationship with them. So it was that they bought maybe a decade or so ago at the beginning of this cycle or the last cycle, and now might be time for them to raise a little cash. So it's not liquidating entire holdings per se, but as you said, these record highs are attention grabbing, especially in Canadian dollars, round numbers, you know, $3,000 an ounce to buy gold. And even, you know, in some cases with the volatility that we've seen to sell gold, you know, it's quite magnificent. So definitely people coming in and selling, and that's outpacing what we're sending out the door. So we are net buyers of gold in this kind of market because people are taking advantage of these record highs.
And maybe related to what we just said, in some instances, the cost of living has gone up. Maybe they've just renewed their mortgage and they have a need for that money. And as you say, you know, they're looking at 3,000 Canadian, you know, when they exchange. And again, that may be part of that scenario that you're reporting. And again, you can find out more. Go to bordergold.com. Rob writes about gold every week there. And stay with us because I'm going to come up. I'm going to talk silver in just a couple of minutes. And in the meantime, Rob, thanks for finding time with us.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thank you, Mike.
You know, it's about time I have something fun and positive to talk about on this station. And you know, I was talking about this in the Polar Plunge just a little bit ago, that everyone can make a difference. But I wanted to talk to a business. It's a smaller business. It's fabulous, though. It's Bluegrass Farms in Armstrong. Terrific bed and breakfast. They also host events there. I mean, it's really cool. If you haven't been to Armstrong, BC, I'm telling you, put it on the map right now. And when you do, go and stay at Bluegrass Farms. But they have been supporters of Special Olympics for the last 4 years, and that's with a significant difference. So I thought we'd just change gears just for a sec. I've got Troy Slievert on with me. Troy, first of all, you know that everybody in Special Olympics knows your name now, so I'll leave that aside in Bluegrass Farms. I just want a quick one. You know, we're out to businesses all the time. Why did you decide to jump in and help?
You know what? It was really intimidating for me when I first started this, right? We are a little ridiculously cute little farm where we grow goats. Mm-hmm. And we actually started a bed and breakfast and that sort of thing. Why did we jump out to it is, even though it was a little bit intimidating at first, you know, we thought maybe there is a chance that we could make a difference. So we worked together and we started off, like for our first year, we just did a two-night stay. And yep. My wife actually happened to mention this to a few small entrepreneurs in town. The first year we had about seven companies come and say, we're going to throw in for this great cause. The second year we had 20 businesses. Right. The third year, we actually, you know, we grew our business enough to start hosting weddings and that sort of stuff. So this last year, we actually did like a full wedding event. I think the biggest thing for us is we might be the small entrepreneurs, right? The little teeny tiny company. But the difference that all these companies have made to actually bring into such a worthy cause, it's unbelievable. And I don't know how to say this, but we did this because we had, you know, we wanted to make a bit of a difference. But, you know, there's lots of guys, I'm sure, driving around right now thinking, how do I get involved in that sort of stuff? You know what? Take the plunge, do it, because not only do you get to sleep really good at night knowing you're making a difference, but also, too, is like bringing the community together and stuff like this. You're going to really realize who is out there and who you want to actually do business with. Because if they're like-minded and big-hearted people, they're going to want to be part of this great cause. And you know what? It's going to build your business. It's going to make you sleep really nice at night knowing you're making a difference. And just the overall positive energy is unbelievable. It's really honestly changed our life. It's changed our business aspect, and it's really shown us what we can do as a community. And that's really, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. It's community, you know? Well, so, boy, it's really made a difference for us.
It's funny. I'm just sitting here thinking, so I've been doing, you know, I've been volunteering. I've been chairman of Special Olympics, you know, and the executive forever, all of that stuff. You just summed it up better than I could after 25 years, because there's several things there. One is, I want people to hear that. Talk about taking a leadership role or stepping up and saying, I want to make an impact in my community, in my province, in my country, and getting other people together. So that's one thing I hear there. The second is, then people thank you for it. They say, hey, this is great. And that's, I just explore a little bit more that, because that's been my experience, is when I tell, you know, it's one of the best things I ever told my kids to do, but other kids, go volunteer. And Special Olympics is a terrific place to volunteer. It's not a lot of time necessarily. Man, does it change their perspective. So I'm really big on that. But, you know, when your business steps forward, you gather around other businesses. That's such a wonderful message about our community. And maybe sometimes we feel a little discouraged about what's happening in certain areas of our country. Fair enough. I'm not getting into that, but I'm saying, what an anecdote or antidote to that. It's both, you know, that you know, the people involved turn around and go, this feels great too. This is great for me, great for our business to be part of something so positive.
Yeah, it's, I really can't stress enough, you know, for all those guys, especially the young guys starting out in business, right? Like, it's terrifying, right? I am literally, you know, having a small business and taking a gamble and you know, investing in myself. It's like a white knuckled ride the whole way.
Yeah.
And this really is, it helps you with your confidence in being an entrepreneur, but it also, it gives you reward. Because there's going to be nights where you're working till 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, and you're thinking, oh, what is this all for? And then you get the phone call, and it's like, hey, Troy, can we, you know, depend on you this year for the Special Olympics? And it's all of a sudden, all that stress, all that, you know, anxiety, everything that comes with being an entrepreneur, it all of a sudden vaporizes, because you don't think about all the long hours. You think about, wow, I am making a difference. Yeah. And, you know, there's going to be some athlete out there that gets to go to a golf tournament, gets to go swimming, gets a medal and sitting on the podium. And you know what? It's people that, you know, step up to the challenge and actually be able to provide that for them, right? So it really is special. But, you know, the one thing I really want anyone out there listening is, it doesn't matter if you're the little fish in the big pond. Step up to the challenge and you watch your whole life will open up, and you honestly won't have a better feeling than making a difference.
I literally can't say it better than that. But I also, a big shout out to your wife too, Thea. You know, you two got together, made this happen, and your partners there in Armstrong, you know, everybody else that Bluegrass Farms. And Dan, I'm going to say, I want that plug in there. You're in Armstrong. You're traveling this summer. You're making plans. They got a bed and breakfast. They got fun things to do there. They can go as far as hosting a wedding, and they will be in a part of our Special Olympics auction, which I'll tell you all about, coming up on June 15th, I think. That's off the top of my head. Don't test me on that one. Those are big numbers. But of course, we'll be talking more about that. But in the meantime, Troy, just know how thankful we are and how impressed I am that you're better at that than I've been. Thanks, Troy.
You betcha.
Time now for the quote of the week. You know, one thing I've noticed in the last year or so is that an increasing number of economists are speaking up, expressing deep concern about what they're seeing in the country, about Canada's economic performance and the consequences for our standard of living. But I've noticed that the criticisms are coming from economists, you know, really, who are usually very careful in choosing their words when it comes to criticizing the government. Got a good example. I really like University of Calgary economist Trevor Tom. He does great work. But he recently wrote this in quotes, "Hard to conclude anything, but the government doesn't know what it's doing." Well, there you go. He's a good economist, and he likes to avoid the drama of politics, and I certainly understand that. So coming from him, it's noteworthy. And I've got other examples, including our quote of the week by Derek Holt, head of capital markets at Scotiabank. And as such, he leads the development, application of forecasts and research in the economy, central bank policy, fiscal policy, financial markets. In a recent article entitled, "It's Time to Stop Believing in Policy Fairy Tales," he states in quotes, "I'm deeply worried about public policy in my country. Productivity is in a tailspin. A greater share of GDP is spent on here today, gone tomorrow, current spending by governments and households than in decades. Tax policy is uncompetitive. Business bashing has become commonplace among people who've never spent 2 seconds working in the private sector. Competition policy changes face serious criticisms. Changes to labor laws have benefited unions, while collective bargaining exercises are driving wage growth to the moon, despite collapsing productivity. Major sectors of the economy are literally being taken over by government. Recent examples, childcare, dental care, now pharmacare. Do we get better quality outcomes in state-run health and education sector? Try visiting the ER lately. Enough said." As I say, interesting, but there's different priorities. I always acknowledge that some people's priority is climate change. Other people's priority is what we're happening in the economy, because it does impact our future standard of living. But an interesting quote from Derek Holt. You you know, in this show, we've been talking about this sort of, well, I shouldn't say it that so casually. We think the major trend, I think the major trend is the devaluing purchasing power of our currency. And that gets reflected in a lot of things. But I think longer term, I have a look at what's going on in the commodity sector, whether it's oil, gold, silver. Today, I want to focus on silver. Mark Brown is the founder of Pacific Opportunity Capital, chairman of Silver North Resources. Mark, we appreciate you finding time for us. I'm going to start with a straightforward question that you turned your company around to focus specifically on silver. What was behind that decision?
Well, that's a great question, and thanks for having me, Mike. You know, silver, we were looking at it last year, seeing a lot of the fundamental changes in the market, and our best projects were high-grade silver projects up in the Yukon, so that was easy. But we looked at the silver market and really realized it's focused and ready to take off because it's participating in two mega trends. One is the currency debacle that's going on and the irresponsible government spending by all the G7 nations, which is why gold is skyrocketing now.
Yeah, and Bitcoin. The other one, I was going to say Bitcoin too. You know, people Bitcoin are looking too, for a yeah. refuge within that. Yeah, and I see that trend, as I said, it's been a major trend for us here on Money Talks, really warning about it since our World Outlook Conference in February of 2020. We think that's the deal. But it's interesting when you're looking at that and you see those signs now sort of getting started to be reflected in the marketplace.
Well, gold's hitting all-time highs right now, Mike, and silver is nowhere near its all-time high. It could easily go back to $50 an ounce here, and it's trading around $25. And these junior resource stocks really get some good leverage on them when the silver price starts to move up.
Yeah. Do you have a time frame for that, or is that how it works when you've got a company to deploy? I'm deploying just, you know, some investment dollars, you know, it's a much smaller deal. But do you sort of go, okay, I've got a 5-year time horizon, you know, whatever, or it's just, as you say, and I'll ask about that second trend in a moment, but you look at these trends all lining up in favor, silver being a mile away from what it was. I remember the Hunt brothers. I remember $55 yeah. an ounce silver, you know, and obviously we're trading, whatever, 23-ish in that range these days. And it hasn't had that budge.
Well, I mean, silver, the market is about 1 billion ounces a year of silver production. And right now the uses of silver are using up about 1.1 billion ounces a year. And they're drawing down on the stocks and inventories that are around the world in various commodity funds and things. And so as that happens, it's going to draw that down and that's just going to run out. And at some point, silver's just going to take off because of that. And silver's production can go up a little bit, but it's quite often a secondary item produced from gold mines. And so the focus isn't on silver as much as it is on gold. So when it does take off, it's very difficult to find new supplies, sources of it.
Yeah, as you say, there's that industrial component that separates it, I think, gold, unless everybody's getting gold fillings this week. But, you know, I mean, we know that silver's used, for example, as, you know, conduction when I'm looking at renewable energy, electronic vehicles, rather, and renewable energy, of course.
Absolutely. I mean, it's used in a lot of the electric connections in the electric vehicles. One of the biggest uses right now is in solar panels, and it's always been used a little bit in solar panels, but they're finding it because silver is the best conductor. You have silicone wafers in the solar panels that create electrons when light gets shone on them, and collecting those electrons is the best thing to use for that is a silver powder they put into the solar panels, making them more and more efficient. And you got to remember, a lot of people around the world still don't have electricity. And they certainly don't have a lot of the technologies that we now take for granted. And so there's growth in the demand for the new green technologies coming out and just basic technologies that are being made more and more efficient by using silver in them, which is generally a low input cost for them.
What do you see in terms of, I mean, I'm with you on the demand side. As I said, we made it very clear on this show that we felt the renewable energy was going forward. And it's an example of whether I like it, don't like it, who cares? I can just see that that's going forward with EVs, et cetera. Has the demand side met it? You know what I mean? As you say, the increased demand for silver, but I meant supply when I said that. Has the supply side matched that demand curve?
Well, this is the thing. The supply of silver, there's very few silver-focused companies out there. There's lots of great deposits out there. But, of course, with mining, you know, they have to be mined and processed. Every deposit's a little bit different. And it takes a long time to build a silver mine now, longer than ever, because obviously modern mining is very responsible in how they do mining, of course. And there's processes, tests, drilling to be done. Even our projects are at early stage. We've already hit high-grade silver in one of our projects, very high-grade, over 1,000 grams per ton in some intercepts, over 3 meters. But that's still got probably 3 to 5 years of drilling to be done. Even though we're next to an operating mine that could process the silver, but it's still quite a bit of drilling to be done. So it's not an overnight thing to increase the silver supply.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the old snap your fingers, because obviously politicians haven't quite learned that lesson yet when they mandate things like we'll all be in EVs by 2035, you know, but they can't describe for me where they're getting the raw materials from, you know, the amounts that we're talking about in that same time frame. And gosh, we're only talking like just over 10 years now. You know, as you say, you find something good, it still takes years to get it into production.
Well, and the silver market's already in a deficit, and using up these supplies, and there'll be some recycling that comes on. And you know, the energy sources, like anything that's realistic, we're going to have multiple different sources of energies, everything from oil to nuclear and everything in between. And solar's a new one that's growing fast right now. But all these different sources are actually being made more efficient by the key conductor, which is silver. And so it's just poised for a huge amount of growth on the industrial side. And then, of course, people are still using it as a safe haven as well. So companies like us have lots of upside potential.
Yeah, well, we look at those technical charts, and they've improved a great deal over the last while. And, of course, on Money Talks, we keep an eye on it. But in the meantime, I want to thank you for taking the time, Mark, and just explaining, you know, where you're coming from is Silver North Resources. But, again, I make investment decisions. You make bigger ones when you talk about the full company. So I appreciate you finding time for us.
Well, thanks for having us, and I hope it was useful for you guys and your listeners.
Great stuff. Time now for the shocking stat of the week. Well, look, there's a major ideological divide, you know, politically in Canada, between those that want far more government intervention in society, you know, through regulation, higher deficit spending, taxation. On the other side, there are those that disagree and would like to see less government intervention in some areas and smaller government overall. That would mean less regulation, maybe balancing the budget, lower taxation. And I'll tell you, there will be no agreement between the two sides. There doesn't seem to be any compromise. But what's interesting is I would think that no matter where you place yourself on that divide, it would seem that effective, efficient government spending, lower levels of waste would be important. But that's not the case. While cases like Arrive Can grab the public's attention for a short while, I can't remember an instance where government's lack of efficiency or misspending, mismanagement was even in the top 10 list of people's concerns when pollsters ask. I'm definitely in the minority who thinks that if I have a legal obligation to pay my taxes, well, government has a responsibility to spend the money as effectively and efficiently as possible. But as I say, I'm in the minority. And as the Auditor General, Parliamentary Budget Office chronicle on a relentless basis, that's not how our money's spent, from Arrive Cam to no cost-benefit analysis on even one green energy program to the lavish spending of the Governor General. And that brings me to my shocking stat of the week. Payroll costs of the federal government have grown 68% since Prime Minister Justin Trudeau took office. A record $67.4 billion was spent last year. As of the end of 2023, there were 428,000 federal employees, and that doesn't include the number of consultants. You know, as the head of the Parliamentary Budget Office, Yves Giraud, told our audience here on Money Talks, we got to decide if we're getting our money's worth. Are services better? Are they run more efficiently? In other words, what specifically did we get for that extra money and those extra people? But arguably the most shocking stat is that, as Mr. Giraud states in quotes, it is not uncommon for departments to have 5 levels of executives and associate deputy ministers and more, maybe more than that, and 1 deputy minister. Bottom line, it leads to a situation where an employee can have 7 levels of management above them. I mean, think about that. Not only as a taxpayer who pays the salaries and benefits, but the inherent inefficiency of having employees having to deal with 7 layers of management. In a word, that's hopeless. No wonder former Auditor General Michael Ferguson stated the structure of the federal government is designed to avoid responsibility. But note, the Parliamentary Budget Office was asked directly if the number of managers and executives could be reduced, he said in quotes, yes, there is room to reduce some levels of executives in the public service. But come on, if anybody actually proposes to reduce that number of executives, they're accused of trying to gut public services. Suggest saving even a dollar is called a draconian cut. You know, and incredibly, millions of Canadians, including some in the media, go along with it. I'm going to finish with a shocking stat example. Now, I appreciate for many, the CBC is a hot button issue due to the perception of political bias. I'm not talking about that. We can debate it another time. In this case, I'm talking about top heavy management structure of government organizations. As Blacklock's reports, think about this one. The CBC now has 144 corporate directors paid an average of $135,000 per year plus benefits. Well, no wonder it's under, in its own words, immense financial pressure, which has now been put on the taxpayer because the mother court just received an additional $96 million tax dollars. Come on, join me on my bandwagon. It's time to examine. I'm not debating policy here. I'm saying it's debating how the policy is actually carried out. You know, some months ago, Ozzy and I talked about a lawsuit in the United States that basically was saying, hey, you guys are colluding on commissions. It's sort of like a monopoly attitude that buyers and sellers, commission agents get together and this is what the commission is. Well, it's wound its way through courts and there's been a major settlement on it that has implications maybe for Canada, certainly as a step because Canada's got a similar lawsuit going forward. I'm going to bring Ozzy in because thank goodness he's here to explain it to us. Ozzy, let's start with the U.S. Example, but with, again, telling people we're having a similar issue in Canada.
Well, first of all, that hit us between the eyeballs because the lawsuit was $1.8 billion. Now, that has now been settled for only $418 million, but it is $418 million. And that is against the National Association of Realtors, which would be in Canada, like Canadian Real Estate Association, represents about a million realtors. But in addition to that, Keller Williams and REMAX and other real estate companies settled for $208 million. So this was a major victory if you're on the side of that agents are vastly overpaid. But the big thing was the claim against the National Association of Realtors, sort of a price-fixing thing, right? So, and by that I mean is that in the agreement that you signed with your MLS, it stated the commission, and while under the old law in the United States you could have negotiated it, most owners wouldn't know that, and then they had to pay what the commission was in agreement, and that's been done away with. One of the issues, the National Association of Realtors agreed to take that out of the contract, and also that the owner no longer has to pay the buyer's portion of commission. And there could be various talks about that aspect of it, but that's part of the settlement.
Now, yeah, in Canada, we don't have that system in place. Like you hire someone to sell your home, you pay that commission, and somebody maybe goes through a realtor to help them buy a home, and that's a separate transaction, a separate commission. In the States, you're saying, now, they got together on that one and decided what the overall deal would be. We don't have that in Canada. I just want to impress upon that. Go ahead.
Yeah, the important thing is that we don't allow dual agency in one realtor. So if I list your house for sale as a realtor, I can't, and you call me and you want to buy it, I can't do that. I said you have to have your own buyer's realtor. The difference is that the two of us, the buyer's realtor and me, you're presenting the buyer, I present the owner. The commission is coming out still out of the pot. So if the commission in Vancouver is 7% of the first 100 and 2.5% in the balance on a $500,000 transaction, the commission in Vancouver make it $1 million transaction, it's $30,000. And that's split between the buying agent and the selling agent. Well, in the United States, there's simply the ruling says the owner no longer has to pay it, the buyer's portion of it. How the buyer gets representation is not really clear. He has to find his own, and he has to find a way to pay that buyer's representation. I mean, to me, I've been in 1,000 real estate transactions, and Mike, particularly a first-time buyer, he needs representation. You know, yeah. I mean, never mind getting the home inspection, but reading it and figuring out and reading starter minutes and all that. But anyways, in the U.S., the way this looks now, he then has to pay his portion that used to come out of the owners, out of the sale price, has to add that to the price. If that's 3% on a $500,000 house, that's 15,000 more that you cannot maybe get by way of mortgage. There's sort of all sorts of issues that are somewhat unsolved.
You know, one of the things that I always find, we get some feedback on this, kind of a, it was a surprise to me at first, and when you pointed out to me that, yeah, this is what happens, is we all don't have the same commission formula across the country, like in Canada, I'm saying. So yeah. I've glibly said stuff about real estate here, there, and the next thing is, well, the commission isn't the same, and that came as a surprise to a lot of people.
Well, and that's, you know, I always argue two commissions, you may think they're high, but they're not as high as Toronto. In Vancouver, it's 7% of the first 100, 2.5% on the balance. In Alberta, it's 7% first 100, 3% on the balance. In Toronto, it's 5% across the board. Now, Mike, the difference is on $1 million house in Vancouver, you pay $30,000, which is split between the two agents. In Alberta, it's $34,000 split. In Toronto, it's $50,000. There's a $20,000 whopping increase on just a $1 million house. So you work that out at $2 million, makes a big difference. So now we have right now a class action suit filed in federal court last month, naming 72 different regional real estate boards, 10 franchisors and brokerages, etc. And they're going after the same issue that the commissions are fixed and prices are fixed and etc. So, but currently in Canada, we have no dual agency. Listing agents can't deal with the buyer. The buyer agent is necessary. Commission comes out of transaction. Whereas the U.S., the buyer commissioner has to be added. So watch the lawsuits pile up, Mike. As lawyers are drooling over.
I was going to say, we're looking for who the winner is. I think we just identified the winner in all of these. I mean, 72 different regional real estate boards. And as you said, 10 real estate franchisers, 8 real estate brokerages, all defendants. Hey, I suspect that's a lot of happy lawyers out of this thing. And a little bit of confusion. Go ahead.
Particularly in the U.S., you have a precedent. You can say, well, look at what they did there. Yeah. So it looks like a win-win. Actually, I think the National Association of Realtors did probably a good job because none of the individual million-dollar agents can be sued. None of the brokers. That's all part of the settlement. It's going away. So anyways, it's an interesting world.
But let's also remind people that there is expertise involved here. You're making, for most of us, for the vast majority of us, this is our most important financial decision. I'm talking on the buy side. You know, once you're in and you're selling it, I don't think it's a lifestyle, yes, but not the sort of fundamental financial because you are taking on debt. You do need expertise. Educate yourself. Go to ozbuzz.ca and you'll get a head start there, you know, when you do that. But no, but education, it's the key. And I know I'm like a walking cliched billboard saying that, but let's not overlook that part of it.
100%. And, you know, certainly I'm very much in favor of having an experienced professional realtor look after you. That's the same with an experienced professional mortgage broker. And don't begrudge them the commission if they are having your best interest at heart. You need one.
Well, as I say, they can go to ozbuzz.ca. And in the meantime, Ozzy, I hope you go and have an absolutely terrific week.
Thank you very much. And talking about sales, one of the famous promoters of sales was Zig Ziglar. Yep. And he says, confidence is going after Moby Dick in a rowboat and taking the tartar sauce with you.
Ozzy Jurek. Let's go live to the trading desk now. I've got Victor Adair with me. You know, Victor, as I watch over these last several months, and again, I could go 20 years, but it is amazing how central bankers dominate the whole sphere of what we're talking about in the markets. It's always, what did this central bank? It's not just the Federal Reserve. I mean, we look at, of course, the Bank of Canada, but it's around the world. And, you know, they had a party this week. I mean, every one of them seemed to have something to say.
Yeah, it was central bank week in a big way this week. Most of the movements or whatever were as expected, a couple of surprises. But let me give you the general theme here is that the Western central banks are sort of delivering a message that would go something like this. Inflation is coming down, not quite as fast as we'd like to see it, but it's coming down. Don't worry. We got it under control here. And we think interest rates have hit their highs, and we expect to be cutting rates some this year and probably some more next year. That seemed to be the general theme of the messages.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. I think people were waiting with bated breath to see whether the Federal Reserve was going to say, yeah, we did have three cuts in the horizon. Maybe we'll go to two. But they didn't do that. And I think there was a big sigh of relief in the market.
Yeah, this absolutely a sigh of relief. I mean, you go back to January, which isn't that long ago, you know, the market was pricing in 6 to 7 cuts, and they kept knocking that back. And now all of a sudden, they were afraid of a reverse going the other way. Certainly, when the Fed did say they expect to cut rates 3 times this year, there you could see it on the like 1 minute charts on the bars here, that the 1 minute bars on the charts, I should say, the market just spiked to the upside, and we had the major stock indices all make new all-time highs this week. Sort of a sigh of relief that, you know, the easy money is coming.
Yeah, it'll be, I mean, everything is so predicated on what the forecasts are for interest or perceptions. And I got to note this, Vic, is not only the Federal Reserve been wrong, well, at least with his hints, you know, that early December, you know, suggesting that we could get a rate decline much sooner. But now, of course, the consensus is pushing it out. As you said, you know, at one point, the market was sort of saying we're going to get a rate cut a month starting in March or something. And I just want to warn people, you know, that's why I remember Richard Russell, the famed old Dow Theory letter writer, saying, be careful following experts, you know, and I think this is a great example. But I think the message is, this is tough stuff. There are so many variables out there. I wouldn't expect them to get it right. And they haven't.
Well, as a trader, one of the things I keep reminding myself of when I'm entering a trade in a market, that there's definitely going to be things going on that'll affect that market that I have no idea about.
Mm-hmm. You know, something else,
yeah, you know, and it kind of keeps you humble when you say put on a trade and suddenly the market goes against you and go, oh, gee, I truly didn't see that coming. But maybe just to finish up with the central banks, the Bank of Japan met on Wednesday. They were, what is it, for the first time in 17 years now, they've bumped interest rates to just fractionally positive, so we don't have negative rates. Japan is actually trying to create inflation. You know, the other way around, the government's encouraging employers to pay their employees more. Looks like wage growth right now is running around 5%. I don't want to get technical here. It's just Japan is a little bit the odd man out with the central banks around the world.
But of course, they started the manipulation of interest rates in 1990, you know, 89, 90, whatever date we want to choose. But that's when they started. And I remember when they, you know, we were in a much higher interest rate environment. And I remember that first decline brought their rates to about 2.5%. I remember everybody was shocked that was even possible. And of course, so they've been 30 years into this stuff. So I'm not surprised they're not quite on the same time frame.
Yeah, Mike, before we go, we got to talk about gold. It did make a new high this week. Immediately after the FOMC conversations and that sort of thing, the gold market was up, as were the foreign currencies against the U.S. dollar, and the stock markets were up. In the what we call the overnight trading session in gold, where the volume is substantially less, participation is less, we had a spike in gold. Like I looked at my screens and thought, wow, what happened? We're up $40 or something like that. I went and searched through the news. I saw nothing. I checked the volumes on the floor. Here's what I think happened, that people had buy stops above the market. And there are folks out there who can see those stops. Believe me, they saw them. They were able to bid the market up, run into those stops, and sell their positions to those people that had the buy stops. And the reason I think that's what happened is because within a few hours, we were right back down again. So folks that were bullish gold going, oh, wow, that's fantastic, new all-time highs. It's kind of a be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, what I like about that, and I appreciate you sharing it with us, Vic, is that it just reminds people we're always looking for some fundamental reason. Why did this happen? Why did this happen? A lot of time it's the internal dynamics of the market. It's the positioning already in the market. You know, whether people are short covering or taking on shorts, or as you've just described, a little bump up in the market so they can unload their position. So I just hope people pay attention to that. It's just not, and that's why there are surprises too, because we don't know everyone's position or attitude about their position. So good stuff as usual. And I want to invite people to go to victoradare.ca, victoradare.ca. Always enjoy looking at those charts and everything. As they say, a picture tells 1,000 words. So you've been speaking volumes lately, Vic. So thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Mike.
Time now for this week's Goofy Award. You know, this week, the CEO of the Niagara-on-the-Lake Public Library, Kathy Simpson, was fired over an op-ed column she wrote entitled Censorship and What We're Allowed to Read. The library board received some complaints over statements like, in quotes, vigorous defense of books promoting diversity of identity, but little to no defense of books promoting diversity of viewpoint and the purchase of books promoting progressive ideas over traditional ideas. In another spin on the censorship wheel, this week the Hamilton Jewish Film Festival was canceled. And finally, in an egregious example of the pervasive push to censor, this week the disciplinary hearings of BC nurse Amy Hamm concluded. But note her crime. She contributed to a billboard that said, I heart J.K. Rowling. That was it. Amy's a single mom, has a baby, a toddler. I think it's difficult to imagine the stress of getting a formal letter informing her she's under the investigation by the BC College of Nurses and Midwives for contributing to a billboard. As Amy writes, the BC College of Nurses and Midwives fought like hell to prevent me from having a single witness to testify in my defense. They spent days and days of the hearing attempting to disqualify every single witness I brought forward. It was as astounding as it was terrifying. Well, thankfully, the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms took her case. And as the Justice Center lawyer for Amy, Lisa Bildy, states, the key issue, in quotes, one we should pay attention, in quotes, the college has allowed itself and its disciplinary process to become participants in a public and political controversy on which it should not be taking a side. The college should enforce high standards of performance for nurses and midwives when caring for their patients. Otherwise, refrain from taking sides on political, cultural, and moral issues that are debated in the public square. The college has lost its way, end of quote. Well, amen. I find it outrageous. But it's a reminder that there are many ways to censor. I mean, look at Jordan Peterson under the College of Psychologists of Ontario, who threatened him with losing his license because a dozen people who he had never met, never been patients, complained about something he posted about. Nothing to do with his work as a clinical psychologist. You know, on Money Talks, we pointed out the continued assault on free speech since 2016. Simply put, some people want to be the arbiter of what's allowed to be said, what you're allowed to read, allowed to see, what opinions are allowed to be expressed. I'm in awe of their arrogance, by the way, and their ignorance in not understanding the role that free speech plays in a democracy. I mean, free speech is arguably the foundation of progress and innovation. I mean, the correlation between free speech and economic growth and a higher standard of living is clear, well documented. You don't have to think too far to look at the comparisons between North and South Korea, East and West Germany, and countless countries behind the Iron Curtain. The free exchange of ideas is the pivotal difference between democracies and totalitarian regimes. And why should you care? Because as Kathy Simpson and Amy Han just experienced, you could be next. And just so you know, Bill C-63, we talked to Michael Geist about that last week. It opens the door to personal attacks on individuals, weaponizing it. In quotes, the poorly conceived Digital Safety Commission lacks even basic rules of evidence, can conduct secret hearings, has been granted an astonishing array of powers with limited oversight. Section 87 of the bill literally says the commission is not bound by any legal or technical rules of evidence. What I'm trying to get across, and we have been on Money Talks, I know, for a number of years, the push to censor is real. And it's growing. And we should all be worried we could be next. Hey, that's all the time we have this week. And just a quick reminder, remember Keystone Financial is going to do a live webinar. You probably can also get it after the fact, but I'm just reminding you that April 2nd at 7 o'clock Pacific Daylight Time, and then April 11th, 7 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. They're available. You can get more details on mikesmoneytalks.ca, but more importantly, you can sign up for the seminar there. So just a reminder, always fascinating to hear what they've got to say. But as I always say, the more education, the better we are. And that includes, by the way, joining us on Money Talks Tweets, Michael Campbell's Money Talks on Facebook, 5 Minutes with Mike, which you can sign up to for free on mikesmoneytalks.ca. And in the meantime, I hope you go out and you have an absolutely fabulous week.